Yeah, please.
I'm a little surprised you didn't have statistics on fatality of dockers or coal miners, because during most of my lifetime, these were among the highest of all occupations.
Well, I didn't make the graph. That was from the Bureau of Labor Statistics.
You're not responsible. You're forgiven. Most of my lifetime, I was a longshoreman, it's among the highest rate of fatalities.
If you look at, there's a slightly different graph that's in that same report. If you look at the Bureau of Labor Statistics website, it's in the Census of Occupational Fatalities for 2007. And there's a slightly different graph that shows the incidence of fatalities by industry rather than by occupation. And in that, mining is at the top. I'm not sure where longshore workers fall in that, but because this was by profession, it didn't show up here.
I'm interested in the hot loss program that you're moving forward.
I'm part of an organization called Rose City Cop Watch. It's been around for a little more than 5 years. Our ultimate long-term aim is to eliminate the police altogether. Our shorter-term aim is to find things that the community can do on its own without appealing to people with authority. That will shift the balance of power between the community and the police. And so with that in mind, we regularly do trainings on your rights in the police, and we also periodically organize patrols in which people go out with video cameras, notebooks, still cameras, that sort of thing, and document what the police actually do when they, pull people over, whatever. And then we also engage in sort of one-time projects with the idea of shifting public discourse around policing. So, for example, a few years ago there was a fatal shooting in which the cops shot and killed a young, unarmed African-American woman named Kendra James. And the community was enraged by this, and it really produced the largest sort of public demonstrations against police brutality that I've seen in Portland. There was an inquest and all that usual stuff. Chief of police was under a lot of pressure from public to fire Scott McAllister, the cop who killed Kendra James, and was under a lot of pressure from the police union to vindicate him. And he tried to split the difference and suspended McAllister for 6 months, with the result that he pleased no one and lost his job. So the chief of police got fired. And everything sort of settled down while McAllister was on his 6 month vacation. And we decided that it would be a good idea to let people know when he was coming back, and in particular to let people know in the neighborhood that he was going to be patrolling. So, we did some detective work and figured out where they were stationing him and what day he was starting work again. And then we were thinking about the way that these two people had been treated in the media, where basically, every bad thing that Kendra James had ever done was on the front page of the paper. Like, day after day, there was just a constant sort of smear campaign of, her arrest record, her juvenile record, her, bad things her teachers had to say about her, bad things ex-boyfriends had to say about her. Like, just really a nasty smear job. Whereas, on the other hand, the only thing that we knew about Scott McAllister was his name and how long he had worked for the police force. We didn't know, there was no information available about his arrest record, about his disciplinary record. There was no information about where he had worked before. There was no information, really at all. And that seemed unfair. So, and in particular, nobody knew what he looked like. We knew his name, and that was it. On his first day back to work, we postered the area where he was going to be patrolling with a very sort of pseudo-official looking poster that said, you know, warning, dangerous killer in area. And also announced a photography contest to see who could give us a verifiable picture of Scott McAllister. This became a huge to-do. Like, the chief of police had a press conference and denounced us, and the mayor had a press conference and denounced us, and the one of the local talk radio guys talked about it for his entire four-hour show for, I think, 3 days in a row. And we got hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of calls, mostly people hating on us. But our answering machine was like, you guys suck, I hate you, delete. You guys suck, I hate you, delete. You guys suck, I hate you, delete. Yeah, I have a picture of Scott McAllister. And so we ended up getting three different pictures of Scott McAllister within a few days of making the announcement. Because somebody just had one. And so we sort of let the controversy die down, and we're waiting to pick our moment. In the meantime, the Portland police shot and killed another young, unarmed black motorist, this time a man named James Jarre Perez. And it was almost exactly, like, the timing couldn't have been worse for them. It was almost exactly a year after the Kendra James shooting. We had just done this good job of reminding everybody about that. And so we thought, okay, well, here's our chance. We're going to, you know, link these two things, put out the poster, get pictures of both these guys. Getting a picture of McAllister turned out to be a piece of cake because he was in the Portland Police yearbook. So we put out this poster that had, you know, pictures of these two guys and some text sort of connecting the two things. And again, the mayor had a press conference announcing us, and the chief of police had a press conference announcing us. And this time, however, we got hundreds and hundreds of phone calls of people asking to get copies of the poster. So clearly something, like, our aim was to sort of change the discourse, and clearly that happened, whether it was all because of our efforts or not. Also, incidentally, since then, every time the cops have shot and killed somebody, the pictures of the cops have been in the paper the next day. And I don't know if we get to take all the credit for that, but it certainly didn't hurt. So, yeah, please.
Yeah, first of all, I'd just like to briefly say that there's a Berkeley Daily Planet commentary recently, I think it was in the issue before this last one, by one of the regular opinion writers, Douglas Allen Taylor. And if anyone hasn't seen it, you should definitely read it. You can find it online at berkeleydailyplanet.com. And Alan Taylor wrote about these former mass auto dragnets in East Oakland. And if you've ever heard blacks talk about, they feel that police are an occupying force. Well, his description of these auto dragnets, I forgot what years they occurred, but in recent years, but I forgot when they stopped in East Oakland, where they would stop, you know, just about every car in the area that they could. And interestingly enough, in this article, it said that for this, you know, for passage of these auto dragnets, they actually confiscated relatively few drugs and arms. So this definitely goes against the stereotype of a poor and working class black neighborhood. So the dragnets weren't even productive. So I just wanted to mention that. And so my questions, and feel free to be as brief as you feel you should so that other people can ask. I'm wondering if you could just maybe say briefly how you got started, because there's no particularly compelling reason for you as a white male to want to take this on, and so I admire that you do. I'm wondering, you know, even many blacks, especially older and upper income blacks, even in this case of the latest scandal in Oakland, talk about, you know,
taught. It's not that we don't want the police. We need the police in our community. And I've often thought, just as you have briefly alluded to, that we, especially some traditional minority community, need to look at alternatives to the police, because, of course, the same people who say we need police, they're going to come across the paradox that more police means more police killings of community members. And I'm sorry, I'm trying to follow my notes here. Have you ever addressed the issue of special prosecutor? Because in this Oscar Grant case, I've been just about the only person that's been active in this case, just as a grassroots activist, calling for a special prosecutor because Trump pointed out that there's an inherent intimate conflict of interest in having a local DA prosecute cop that he has to work so intimately with.
Right. Okay, I'm going to try to run through those in reverse order. So if by the time I get to the end I forget what the question was, you'll have to remind me. I haven't really given much thought to the idea of a special prosecutor. I certainly haven't written about it anywhere. It's an interesting idea. You're definitely right that there's an inherent conflict of interest between getting the local DA to prosecute the local police. And the reason for that is that, and this is well under, this isn't like my conspiracy theory, this is well understood in the professional literature, both for sort of legal scholars and for sociologists and such that study the cops. That the police, the DA relies on the cops to provide the evidence in all of their cases. If they can't rely on the cooperation of the police, then the district attorney's office can't function. And that works both at the level of like, and this has happened before, where a junior prosecutor will go after some low-level cop for something, and all of a sudden, all of his cases dry up. So, you know, and that's basically just them shutting down his career at that point. It's also worked at the level of a DA's office starts to get serious about civil rights, and the usually the police union decides to withdraw support from him around election time, and to, you know, and then they do some campaigning that says that, you know, he's soft on crime, he's inept, he's corrupt, he's, you know, whatever. Which is, you know, totally fatal to, but because of the politics of sort of law and order issues, if the police withdraw their support from a DA who's in power, that's basically the end of his term. And so, yeah, there's built-in incentives for the district attorney to go soft on the cops, and they almost always do. It would really take a remarkably brave person who wasn't particularly concerned about his career to do otherwise.
If I can take an objection,
sure.
My husband is an attorney, and she put it even more bluntly than that. She said that if you're a local DA and you prosecute the police that results in any serious time, probably prosecute the couple, that results in any serious crime, you can kiss your future career goodbye.
And I'm sure that that's true. And the question is, would a special prosecutor solve that? And I haven't really looked into it, so I don't have an answer for that. More importantly, I think, and I'll segue into the next question back, rather than addressing these issues simply sort of awful case by awful case, we really need to look more seriously at the institution as a whole and the job that it does in society and the way that it operates and look for... And so the argument of my book, which I'll just give away now, is that if we try to understand the police as chiefly concerned with crime, you have a hard time explaining a lot of what they do in those terms. And, for example, racial profiling as a crime-fighting tactic just fails. It's a persistent disaster from that standpoint. This has been studied, like every credible study on racial profiling has reached two basic conclusions. One is that it exists and is standard, and the other is that it is absolutely worthless for getting drugs or guns or felons off the street. That in most cases, randomly searching the population as a whole is more effective than targeting minority populations, and the hit rates tend to be higher in among stops of whites, probably because the stops of whites aren't random, right? Like, if they stop the white, there's usually some reasonable suspicion or probable cause. So that makes no sense. So why do they keep doing it? Like, they've read the studies. They know it doesn't work. Well, okay, if we look at it from the perspective of the cops not chiefly being concerned with crime, but instead their main function being to preserve existing inequalities, well, then things like racial profiling make a lot more sense. They do serve that function very well. So the argument in my book is that that the main role of the police is to preserve inequality, to keep the people who are at the bottom, to keep the people who are at the top at the top. And that's especially true in terms of race and class. So, that said, the problem that every critic of the police has to address somehow is that of crime. And I spend the last chapter of the book, it's labeled an afterword, but it's sort of because it's kind of after the history part, talking about alternatives to the police. So the chapter's called Making Police Obsolete. And rather than sort of write up the kind of anarchist fantasy about, you know, how, well, there'll be a revolution, there'll be an even society, and crime will disappear, and it will all be teddy bears and rainbows. I looked at what actual people have done in situations where counting on the police for crime control has no longer been an option. And so I look at a couple sort of small-scale examples from U.S. history, one being the Seattle General Strike of 1919, in which the unions suddenly found themselves holding more power than the city government. And in part, in an effort to avoid panic, organized sort of crime control units that were called the Labor War Veterans Guards. They got vets who had just gotten back from World War I with the idea that they would be, you know, disciplined and used to working in a unit and that sort of thing, and organized them into squads and gave them the job of maintaining order. And I'll actually read the, I said I was done reading, but I'm not. I'll read the instructions that were written on their headquarters. Okay. The Labor War Veterans Guard's mission statement. The purpose of this organization is to preserve law and order without the use of force. No volunteer will have any police power or be allowed to carry weapons of any sort, but to use persuasion only. And now that doesn't sound very promising, but as it turned out, when the military actually intervened in the strike, the communications from the commanders were astonished at the orderliness of the city. And, in fact, overall crime seems to have gone down during the strike, despite the fact that the police were occupied with, you know, trying to get the docks open. So that's one case that I look at from American history. I look at the similar sort of community peacekeeping efforts that came out of the Civil Rights Movement and the Black Power Movement. And then I look at a couple much more developed cases from other countries. In particular, I talk about this type of organization called the Street Committee that originated in South Africa under apartheid. Now, clearly, the black population, like, there was just no pretense in under apartheid that the police were going to protect the black community. And in the context of the anti-apartheid struggle, it was inadvisable to call the police about regular social crime. And so it fell to the anti-apartheid organizations to come up with something else to do to resolve disputes and keep the peace and that sort of thing. And they came up with this extremely localized, hence the name Street Committee, a sort of organization that would hear complaints and do investigations and did its best to function under a pattern of restorative justice rather than retributive justice. So rather than, you know, finding the bad guys and punishing them, the idea was to figure out, you know, what went wrong that this disagreement is happening and what has to happen to resolve it. And they also had the more distasteful task of figuring out who the snitches were and taking care of them. Interestingly, these street committees have survived into the post-apartheid era, and where they continue to exist have approval ratings that would be the envy of any police department in the world. And they've under the new regime, they've had this sort of tenuous agreement with the cops, where the cops just aren't interested in handling low-level offenses, and will refer them to the street committee instead. So that's sort of one case that I look at in some detail. The other that I look at is a project that developed in Northern Ireland during the 90s called Community Restorative Justice Northern Ireland. And the history here is also pretty interesting. When the Troubles were really hot, the British government just gave up policing militant areas. And they did so for two reasons. One was that it was dangerous. And the other was that they were hoping that social crime would fester and break down the community solidarity and make it them, you know, easier to reconquer, basically. And the people in the community basically turned to the IRA and said, okay, look, you drove the British out of North Derry, but what are you going to do about crime? And the IRA was completely unprepared for this. And so, and they weren't a police agency. They didn't have detectives. They didn't have holding cells. They didn't have any of that stuff. So they responded to this problem the way they responded to most problems, which was with violence. So they would find people who were accused of various social crime, you know, beating their wife, selling drugs, whatever, and break their legs. Usually the first offense would be a strong warning. The second offense, they would break their legs. This was not seen as a improvement. And it made the IRA became increasingly unpopular as this progressed. And so they, starting in the 90s, they started looking for a way to disengage responsibly. They wanted something that would get them out of the job of controlling crime, but also not let the British back in controlling crime. And so they did something really remarkable, and they went to people who were experts in nonviolent conflict resolution and said, look, will you design us a system that will do this, that can operate out in the open, that will follow the law, that will not rely on violence, and that will include the community as participants in sorting these things out. And so there was a long period of study in which they had meetings block by block and sometimes building by building, asking what people wanted from a justice system. And they actually came up with something that ended up looking a lot like the street committees in South Africa. It was very local. It was more or less democratic. There were certain due process guarantees, like people who were accused of things had a right to, you know, see the evidence and respond and confront their accuser and that sort of stuff. And there were a sort of escalating series of sanctions, the most severe of which was a community boycott, in which if you, you know, weren't doing the work to make amends, you risked nobody hiring you, nobody renting to you, nobody selling you groceries, you know, nobody dating you, like basically like full ostracism. And the places where they implemented this, it was extremely successful. In fact, I really went looking for criticisms, and the only one that I could find was from the Royal Ulster Constabulary. Even the parole office said that this was doing a remarkable job of controlling crime in some very rough areas, and was also doing a exemplary job of reintegrating former offenders, including former combatants, into the community. Interestingly, after the Good Friday talks, it became a major point of contention whether or not Sinn Féin was going to endorse a new reconstituted police force, and the whole peace process almost fell apart around this point. Eventually, Sinn Féin gave in, and so now there are, you know, nice Irish lads patrolling Irish neighborhoods instead of the Brits. So, that said, the restorative justice programs are continuing in those areas, even though Sinn Féin has started cooperating with the police. And also, I think, very interestingly, the model's been imitated in Protestant areas as well that were particularly militant. Sorry, this is a very long answer to a very simple question.
That's great.
Forthcoming, and I don't really get to take credit for this, Rose City Cop Watch has been doing a research project of finding existing examples currently in the U.S. of things that people are doing other than calling the police to handle crime. And we have a draft of a pamphlet that profiles 20 or 30 of these things. And the final pamphlet should be out in probably within a year. So if you are interested in finding that when it comes out, either check our website, which is rosecitycopwatch.org, or send a note to info@rosecitycopwatch.org and tell them that you heard me talk for way too long and that I'm told you.
Interesting. Can you just please answer
another question? Sure. Right. Well, a couple things. My politics have been basically anarchist since I was a teenager, which gave me a sort of predisposition to criticizing and disliking the police. In 96, I was badly but not terribly hurt at a demonstration against the Democratic National Convention, which certainly did a certain job focusing my attention. At that point, I became more politically sort of concentrated on police stuff, and I really wasn't satisfied with the level of analysis that was available from the left overall. It seemed mostly to be sort of reductive and thin. And so I started looking for, you know, what, you know, the other analyses, like, and I realized that the other analyses, the conventional analyses, weren't really very good either. So I ended up writing this book largely because it was the book that I set out to read when I felt like I would be better off if I understood more about this institution. And the book wasn't there, so now it is. I've taken three questions from men in a row, and I would like it if other people would talk as well. I'm not just going to conscript people and like start pointing random women in the crowd. So, okay, there, please. Could you speak up, please?
Would you repeat the
question? Really reforming or not abolishing altogether the state institutions
So the question is, if I can unjustly paraphrase it, what do the cops think of this? Well, mostly they've ignored it. The first reading I ever did was at a bookstore in Portland, and I showed up, you know, kind of like I did today, except without the technological problems, and checked in with the manager of the store to make sure that everything was set, and he told me very, very nervously that cops have been coming in all week asking about the book, and that several of them had bought it and said that they were planning on coming. Which, this was the first time I had done any talking about this at all, so I was already so nervous, it just didn't matter. Like, they could have told me the building was on fire, I wouldn't have been any more nervous. And so I went, I gave my talk, I noticed that there were some large white guys with short hair. They sat with their arms crossed and listened politely and then left at the end and didn't ask any questions. I doubt I convinced them, but they were, polite enough not to heckle me. Other than that, I've gotten some interesting responses from retired cops. And I think people who are very familiar with how these institutions work, once they get outside of them, I think their perspective tends to change, and they wonder a little bit about some of the things that they have witnessed. One of them is a cop in Portland, a retired cop, who actually wrote a little blurb on the back saying that he thinks that it should be mandatory reading for police academy students. I got a similar blurb, but one was enough, but I got a similar blurb from a retired cop from Baltimore. I've also heard from a retired prosecutor in Boston who was, was probably like my biggest fan. He was so enthusiastic, it was a little bit creepy. And recently, I saw a short and kind of understated review on the blog of this guy who used to be chief of police in some little town in the Midwest and now is a security consultant. And he wrote a little review saying how much he doesn't like the title and that it was better than he expected, basically. And that in particular, he thinks that the stuff I talked about tonight about reframing the question of police violence was something that law enforcement professionals should consider, which, is nicer than I was expecting. Yes, please.
With all this nice information, is there a place on this agenda to let people see about how we can use this kind of thinking? Discussion?
Gio, would you like to talk about some local stuff? Or?
Sure. I mean, I was actually going to ask you, because I know Christian obviously isn't from the Bay Area, but has been paying attention to what's been going on here, specifically the Oscar Grant case, right, and the Lavelle Mixing case.
A little bit. I mean, I know what I read in the paper.
And I just draw from two of the things that you said I think seem particularly relevant. One is the amazing demonization of not just Lavelle Mixon, but also Oscar Grant. I mean, Oscar Grant being someone who was shot in the back for no apparent reason at all, and yet his police record was on the front pages. But especially with Lavelle Mixon, who we see is being accused of a rape that he was never indicted for, tried for, convicted of, and yet this is being released as though it were fact.
It hasn't been confirmed.
And the police already said that they couldn't indict him because they required another DNA test. And yet, as you said, we don't know anything about the police, so we have to look very hard to find the police. And if you look, you find out that almost all of them have been investigated for some kind of serious offense, especially the one who wasn't killed but was only injured, was Pat Gonzalez, who murdered Gary King and murdered one other person and paralyzed another person. So this is an officer who's been involved in multiple shootings.
And also, if you look into his record, he was being investigated for sexually assaulting several people. So these are the things that we aren't told. And the other thing that was interesting is the focus on the individual case, which seems to be a lot of the sort of target of a lot of the book. Not just the case itself as an individual event, but the moments. As you said, it's trying to explain it through the moments surrounding it. And I think we saw that very clearly in Oscar Grant, with all these efforts by the press to try to figure out what the cop was thinking, you know, all these things, whether it was provoked. And yet, I think because of what happened in the Lavelle Mixon case, the moment, the police don't want to talk about the moments, because they don't want to talk about whether they rashly went in looking for revenge and got killed, because they don't want to talk about strategic errors that were made. And so this, you know, and so the state general just sort of takes over and actually eliminates the specificity of the moment. So I don't know if there's anything that has struck you about what's been going on here, but it all seems very relevant to what folks are going
on. The thing that strikes me as remarkable about the Oscar Grant case isn't anything about Oscar Grant or the cop or that particular set of events. It's the community response since then. And this is, I talk a little bit in the first chapter, the part that I didn't read, about the sort of the riot theory of like why it is that half a million people every year are hurt by the police, and only sporadically is there unrest like that. And the sociological thinking is that it's a mistake to look at it sort of like as a one incident and be like, well, what makes this one different? That instead there's this, the term the Kerner Commission used was a reservoir of grievance that accumulates over years, and then eventually it's too much and something happens. Like, there's an incident almost always involving the police, which almost always seems like any number of other things before it, but for some reason it sparks, unrest. In this case, it seems like it would be much more surprising if there. So usually the question is, well, why this and not something else? In this case, it seems like there are actually answers to that question. One answer being the video camera. The other answer being that, this is clearly a person who, like, wasn't even in any really meaningful sense a suspect. He just literally was at the wrong place at the wrong time and black. And, but, these are sort of related causes, because that probably wouldn't matter if it weren't for the video camera. And so, I talked a little bit about my work with CopWatch, and the our hope in doing that kind of work is not that, like, everybody will join our group and we'll, be huge. It's instead that by doing this work, we can create this kind of regular practice of CopWatching, so that people do it all the time, so that when the cops pull somebody over in front of your house, you come out on the porch and see what they're doing, rather than sort of closing the drapes and hiding inside. And and I think that the fact that the video camera sort of gave the community the information they needed to be able to respond in the way that they have shows the importance of that sort of informal, at the moment, community cop watching, rather than it being sort of the monopoly of a particular organization. Back to you, please. Did that help, or did you want something more specific?
It is approach my question.
Okay.
Which was, is there opportunity on agenda here for a discussion among the people to go over what you've been presenting?
You mean like break into small groups or something?
No, which is substantial, what you've been presenting. and to see how this is of any, besides being a lecture, like we're empty vessels or not, and do people have responses that they want to put out that talk about the possibilities of integrating that information into the work we're already doing, or showing what work we're already doing so that we can organize around it.
Well, I mean, if you have comments.
I think that's also the purpose of the complex organization here, is to supplement this, or to enact what this lecture provides information around.
So, Anna, did you want to say something about that?
I was just surprised with the, I mean, it's not really that surprising, but I guess I'd never been old enough or whatever when cops were killed before, about the huge media hoopla that there was about the four who were just killed in Oakland. I mean, it was just people, I was at the gym while it was on TV, and the caskets and the flags and, you know, the giant stadium and all these people crying on the road as they go past. And I just wanted to hear what you think, you know, the purposes those serve are, and also, like, do they work, doing that kind of hoopla, you know, to show the state is strong. And
It's totally cynical. There's an opportunity here for the state, right? Because nobody wants to, like, I don't know. Nobody wants to talk shit about a funeral, you know? Like, it's just bad form. But it is. It's what happens when cops get killed, and it's completely cynical, and it has very little to do with the grief of the family or the marking or celebration of this person's life, or even real, or any of the stuff that we're supposed to pretend like it's, you know, all about. It's there largely to create a kind of spectacle that will motivate our sympathies in a way that will sort of shut down our critical thinking, so that we don't ask the hard questions about, tactical mistakes that may have led to the situation in the first place, but also so that we imprints on us this idea of police heroism, so that other criticisms of other cops also are expected to be muted. I mean, it's something very similar to the kind of thinking that, once we're at war, you have to support the troops, right? And it's sort of the same thing. It's like, the police are at war, and we have to support the troops, even if we don't like the war, even if we don't agree with everything that they do. We have to support the troops. It's the same sort of vague, patriotic kind of idea that the purpose of which is to put the police beyond our question. Mostly it works. I don't know if it works to persuade people very much, but it at least works to shut them up, which, you know, mostly is enough. Bunch of hands. You in the back.
Shameless plug. The local Top Watch has recently formed in the wake of the Oscar Grant murder and is now meeting on Wednesdays at 7 o'clock at the Interfaith Friendship House on International. So if anyone's interested, we encourage you to join us in strategizing how to observe police misconduct.
You mean Intertribal Friendship House? Is that what you mean?
Yep.
Intertribal.
Okay, good. Can you repeat that again, please?
Every Wednesday, currently at 7 o'clock p.m. at the Intertribal Friendship House on International, I believe it's 6th and International.
Between 5th and 6th.
5th.
Okay. Yes.
I also have the Shameless Plug for other work that's going on, specifically in response to the Oscar Grant shooting. There is a campaign called No Justice, No BART, which is specifically addressing a number of community demands, including disbanding the BART police entirely. And for those of you that don't yet know, subsequent to a number of mobilizations. They have produced a scope of work request for an investigation that specifically will ask whether or not BART police, whether BART actually needs to have police or whether they need to be armed. And
keep telling me.
Right. And this Thursday at this Thursday is the next protest in that series at MacArthur BART at 4 p.m. So that's 2 days from now. And all of you are more than encouraged to attend. I have flyers for people, and if you want to help organize a sign-up sheet and so forth. So
I think what strikes me about this Oscar Grant thing, and then the cops getting shot, is in a sort of in a metaphysical sense how these two events could happen right here in Oakland in such a short span of time. And I can't remember any two sort of opposing events like that happening like that just here, and which would lead one to examine it more closely. I was in a news intensive with Tim Redman from, he's the editor and has been forever of the San Francisco Bay Guardian, and we were going over the history of BART police shootings, and he actually brought along a few documents, and it was sort of an exercise in reporting. And he agrees with you that the thing that made the difference was the video cameras. But even looking at the statements and of the various cop shops of the, you know, it was like this is so something so wrong with this picture. But these BART killings keep happening. Well, now that this has happened with the cops, and it's still one of those stories. Like so many things jump out at you. Like what's wrong here? What's wrong here? I mean, as a journalist, I see that. But Is this gonna blunt because the BART police really have a huge problem, and half a year they've killed many people. Is this latest incident gonna blunt anything being done about that? Because they put Messerly was going to have a hearing. He was the guy who shot Oscar Grant. They put that on hold after the cops got shot. So what do you think? I mean, just have you had any experience with this?
Okay, so the question is, will the shootout and its aftermath sort of get in the way with things developing from the Oscar Grant case? And I think the answer is it could, but it's up to you. Like, if people let it, then it will. And if people refuse to let it, then it won't. It certainly became harder to organize around the Oscar Grant case because of this incident. Like, the sympathy is going to shift somewhat. But that shift isn't permanent. And so, you know, I don't have a crystal ball that I can say exactly what's going to happen. But I think that it's largely going to depend on the political will of people who are interested in doing something about this already. Yeah, go ahead.
So this question ties directly to what she was saying. I know you were talking about how there have been unarmed kind of citizen police sort of that have been enforcers of the peace in areas, and it's worked quite effectively. But at the same time, you said that you used to be an anarchist, or you were an anarchist, but you understood kind of that the anarchist fantasy of people just kind of getting along wasn't really going to happen.
Well, that's not really what I said. I said I didn't think there was a. I didn't think it would be helpful for me to write out that narrative in the after the book.
Well, my question is: is it really realistic to have a society enforced by people without weapons in the face of organized crime? And the second part is: if it is, then how can you frame it to people to get over their fears of organized crime?
Good question.
Yeah. The is it realistic? I think it is. The evidence for that is not just the historical evidence that I provide in the afterword, but if you look at my footnotes, you'll also see other things that I cite that I don't really go into. But basically, anywhere that social conflict has reached a particular point, it's become the job of the social movement to address crime. Because the legitimacy has shifted away from the state and toward the social movement. And so, and there are, and some of them have handled it well, and some of them have handled it badly. Some of them have handled it basically in ways that are exactly state-like, even without forming the state. But there's quite a lot of documentation about that. And if you're interested, I can give you sources later. But the fact that on a small scale, repeatedly in history, that's been shown to be successful makes me think that it could be. Also, is a more sort of large narrative kind of answer. We didn't always have the system that we have now. We didn't always have the criminal justice system characterized by armed groups of men patrolling the community looking for disorder and putting people in prisons for long periods of time. Like that's a relatively new way of doing things. And the fact that in a relatively short amount of time, a new social organization like that can arise based on changing social conditions suggests that if social conditions change further, we can get rid of it. Logically, I think that's sound. The, how we sell it to people, I think part of it will be showing the successes that they're already familiar with and things that do something about crime that usually aren't thought of as having anything to do with crime at all, or having very little to do with it. Like, for example, here's an interesting thought experiment that, unfortunately, I don't think we can test empirically. But which do you think has done more to reduce drunk driving? Police checkpoints or Alcoholics Anonymous? I'm pretty sure it's Alcoholics Anonymous, although, again, there's no way to verify that. That's not a organization that people typically think of as having anything to do with crime at all, because it addresses root causes that then don't manifest in crime.
What's the root cause of alcohol?
Well, I mean, it doesn't address that root cause, but it addresses the precipitating effects of crime. I think, finding the examples, finding the places where it works, and encouraging people to imagine things differently is, the best we can do. I'm sorry, did you have a second question?
My second question was how you sell it to people, but I guess you could branch that off into how can we apply that. And what can we as people do to kind of make that, more of a reality? What are some, like, incremental steps that we can do to improve it? Like, what are some steps that CopWatch can do?
Well, I don't have a, 10-point plan for moving from here to the society that we want. One of the things that we've been doing is we've been looking at what other people have been doing. And we've been trying to shift the dialogue around it. We've been trying to create dialogue around it. Getting people talking about alternatives to police. And we haven't been at the point of, creating restorative justice program. I don't know if that's ever going to be the work of our organization in particular. But we have been finding other groups in other places that have been doing that sort of thing in the U.S. right now, with success.
You mentioned the 1919 Seattle General Strike. There was another interesting strike in that year, 1919, in Boston, and that was by the police.
Yeah.
And I have a few questions. One of which is, you consider the police part of the working class. I'm a member of the Longshore Union, and one of the first points in our Constitution is we do not allow police to be members of our union because of the role that they played in the 1934 strike, killing six strikers up and down the coast. And also because probably a lot of our members see them as bounty hunters.
Right.
Anyway, that's one question. The role, are police considered, in your view, part of the working class? Second question is, well, I commend the Cop Watch for the work they're doing around monitoring police. I think more in line with stopping police violence against the community is what the Panthers raised and what they actually did, the Black Panthers here in Oakland back in the 60s, which was the right, calling for the right to self-defense, and they did use self-defense against police, and I think that helped to back the police off before they came running into the community like an occupation army, which is what's happening now again. And then I think it's more than just the police. I think it's the justice system. The police don't always pull the trigger and kill innocent civilians. More often, I think what they do is frame up people, like Mumia Abu-Jamal, and accuse them of killing cops or killing someone else, and then they're railroaded, and then the state executes them, like what may happen to Troy Davis in Georgia or Tookie Williams over here in San Quentin. It happens all the time. So it's more than just the police. It's the state, if you will. Finally, I want to say I was one of the people that was arrested and beaten by police at the beginning of the war here on the dock. It was a demonstration, and the police came in riot gear. They were given a green light by the anti-terrorism agency that was set up here in California by the Democratic Party. And I emphasize Democratic Party because this war on terrorism, a lot of the legislation was taken over from the Republicans, and the Democrats ran roughshod to show how patriotic they are and how they can fight the war on terrorism here in the United States better than the Republicans, because that's what's happening now. I think our state is turning into a national security state, and a lot of the civil liberties that even maybe privileged white people had experience in the past is going to be gone. I know what's happening right now on the waterfront is that workers are being required to have these new biometric identification cards in order to go to work that can track them anywhere they're going. You have armed Coast Guardsmen and Department of Homeland Security agents patrolling the docks now. And our docks aren't just commercial docks, there's also parks where we have concerts out there. This landscape is changing very radically, and I wanted to get your opinion on what you think of the national security state and how the police fit into all that, and what we as workers and people in the community can do to challenge that and struggle against it.
Okay, so...
A lot.
Yeah, I'll start at the beginning. I talk about the Boston police strike and the 1934 Longshore strike, both in some detail in the book. So I'm not going to go into the details of either of those cases right now. The question of whether the police are working class, I also go into at some length. But I think it's an interesting and important question, so I'm going to start on an answer now, and then if you really want the whole thing, you should look in the book. But the short answer, I think, is no. And the reason for that being that part of their job as police is to provide sort of a management function for society as a whole. So that they are part of the regulation and coercion apparatus, specifically against the working class. And so, and again, if we think about this sort of in terms of like historical analogy,
the police evolved from this earlier institution, the slave patrols. And at a certain point in the development, the slave patrols became professionalized so that it wasn't just sort of posse style. It was, you know, the same guys every day going out and riding horses and looking for the slaves. In that circumstance, it's just so clear that the point of the institution is to control the workforce, that it really, like, you really have to view them as part of the management of society as a whole, not of some particular firm, rather than as part of the working body. So, similarly, if we look at sort of the role of Pinkertons in the 19th century, like, yeah, you know, they work for wages, they don't own the means of production, etc. Well, that's, you know, that's true of the manager at Denny's, too. So, you know, why isn't he in the union? Well, probably there's no union at Denny's. But if there were, why wouldn't he be in it? Well, because his job is to wrench as much profit out of the people under him as he can manage and to, you know, make sure that they're doing what, you know, he's the representative of the real owners. And in a certain respect, I think the police are the representative of the ruling class rather than, you know, they're not the ruling class, but they do their dirty work. So, no, I don't think so. And I've used the term police union like a dozen times while I'm talking. And, you know, in some respects, police unions are labor organizations. I don't think they are unions in the way that other organizations are unions. And part of that is because they are, their relationship with the management is very different than the relationship with management with, between most other unions and the bosses. Margaret Levy did a good study of this and referred to the police relationship as collusive bargaining. And the police unions do also provide this important function for the police department as a whole, in that they sort of carry the political water. They do the lobbying. They do the they defend the indefensible that a professional administrator would get in trouble with if he put forward the sort of agenda. But the agenda is basically identical. You know, there may be disputes about grievances, there may be disputes about wages, but none of that is really that important relative to the institution's aims for the society as a whole. And more, more often than not, the police union is the mouthpiece for that agenda. The police were in the midst of a sick out in 1967 when Detroit broke out in rioting. And practically instantaneously, the conflict between the cops and their bosses just vanished. And the police immediately went back to work and immediately got their raises, which I think tells you something about the ultimate commitments of both parties. As for, you know, the issue of you know, self-defense, armed self-defense, that sort of thing, I think that that's mostly a strategic question that is going to depend based on local conditions at a particular point in time. The group that I'm part of, Rose City Cop Watch, we have as part of our protocol that we don't carry any offensive weapons while we're on patrol. In fact, we like meticulously like check our stuff and empty out our pockets before we go out to make sure that nobody has a pocket knife or anything that could be misconstrued as a weapon. And the reason for that is because if we get busted on patrol, we want it to be totally clear that it's because we're cop watching and not because we were doing something else that we shouldn't have been doing, saying we were cop watching. That said, you know, the conditions in which a group of unarmed people with video cameras are, an effective check on police behavior are not just universal. They're not always going to be there, I don't think. And they haven't always been there in the past. So, under other circumstances, I can see that it would be certainly justifiable and perhaps wise for other groups to go armed. That's not something that we do. I hope I equivocated enough there. As for what to do about the encroaching national security state, I think resisting in the small things helps stop the big things from happening. Doing the local work builds toward the national work. In general, I think what we need to do is find the places that that they're weak. Find things that the state needs that it can only get from us. And then organize people to deny them those things. And a big thing that they need is legitimacy. And what? Legitimacy. You know, they rely on people acknowledging and respecting their authority and trusting their word more or less and that sort of thing. And damaging that is a prerequisite to organizing to damage them in other ways. I'm getting a run of men again. So. Thank you. Could you shout?
Oh, sorry. The idea is essentially to avoid
right.
Well, I was just wondering what's going to prevent, because it sounds like what Cop Watch is doing now is providing a check to the existing power structure.
We're trying.
Which sounds like a great idea. You know, this is some checks and balances to power. But if we get rid of the officers that exist now, what prevents, what checks the rise of just a new power, neighborhood bosses,
right.
Community witch hunts, like what keeps the communities honest?
Did everybody hear the question? Do I need to repeat it? Okay. The question was roughly, assuming we can get rid of, the state, the cops, the stuff we don't like, and what keeps new power from being just as bad? And I think this is probably not going to be a very satisfying answer, but I think it depends on how you organize it. Like, we need to create institutions that meet our standards and that are, democratic and transparent and accountable and, all of the things that, we say we want the state to be. But that aren't, all the things that the state is, that aren't relying on violence, that aren't reinforcing inequality, that sort of thing. What will make that, one way or the other, is us. Either we'll do a good job organizing it and come up with better outcomes, or we'll do a crappy job and come up with something crappy. And, there's no magic answer, and there's no, there's no, big parent who's going to come in and pull the kids apart. Like, we just have to do it. And I hope we get it right. Yeah.
Yeah, I hate to sort of ask the same question again. I think it's been asked a couple times, but I'm wondering, I know you've done all this analysis, so maybe that's why we're really trying to push you for this, an example maybe of what you would consider to be an acceptable transitional phase in between what we have now and where we want to get.
Uh-huh.
Because obviously you look at a place like maybe a Somalia or somewhere where the government is just collapsed.
Right.
And, you know, say you have people policing, but it's still coercive, and obviously it's basically like gangs for, policing the society. So there's immediate needs, human needs that need to be met in a just society as well. I mean, obviously, if you just had a total collapse of any police system, that gives the ability for, say, like happened in New Orleans, a bunch of white supremacists to go around and shoot black people at will.
Right.
You know, for example. So what would you kind of see as an acceptable transitional period looking like?
And I'd like to jump in on that question, too.
Sure.
But I'd let him answer first. And
great. Awesome.
Okay. You sure? I've had a couple goes at it.
Okay. And it ties back to your earlier question. Okay, well, how do we get people to move from where we are now a bit more towards this direction? Even though if most people aren't going to say, let us get rid of the cops tomorrow, right? And I think your story about Ireland and South Africa was really powerful for me because they're very different places, but they came up with similar solutions. Mm-hmm. And what they basically had to do to come up with those solutions was sit around and have some common sense. I mean, really, right? And so, how do we get people to a restorative model? Because that word keeps coming up, restorative, which basically means like, all right, y'all had something between you guys. What can we do to fix it and make it better? Instead of just punishing you, giving you time out or putting you in jail for a while, right? And I think like here in California, it starts a lot with, so talking about restorative things. We're talking about drugs. Well, let's talk about rehab instead of talking about throwing you in jail, throwing away the key, right? And I think a big piece of that is getting people to think of the folks going to jail as being their brother, their cousin, their sister, Because what's happened in California is that, and all over the country, I'm sure, right, is that the people making the laws are not the folks being affected by the laws, right? It's like the people deciding three strikes and, whatever it is, how they decide how much power the cops get and how much, what's going to happen to you if you do get arrested, are not the same folks feeling that impact, right? So I think it's about talking about restorative and then getting...
Okay, let me go from that. One thing to keep in mind when push, there are sort of common sense reforms that sort of move people in that direction. One thing to be careful of is that the reforms limit the scope of state power rather and reinvest that power in the community rather than expanding the scope of state power. So it's very easy to look at something that, certainly sounds like a good idea, like probation and parole. Okay, so we're not going to put you in jail right now. We're going to, assign you the social worker who's going to, see how you're doing and check in on you and whatever. But the ultimate outcome of that turns out that the people who are on probation and parole lead these extremely restricted, highly monitored lives that nobody else would tolerate and, as often as not, end up going to jail anyway on some totally petty bullshit offense. So we need to be careful about how we, how we manage the reforms that we push. In the bigger sense, I think, something like the Restorative Justice Northern Ireland project provides, a kind of transitional model. As it happened, now they're in this awkward position of trying to continue doing this work in the community when their political sponsors have jumped ship on them. And part of the reason for that is that, it was never Sinn Féin's hope to get rid of the state. It was their hope to take over the state. And for practical reasons, created this non-state autonomous community entity, which eventually, they ended up being at cross purposes. So I think, aligning our means and our ends is also an important point in developing those things that matter. As it happens, I think that, I'm pretty excited about the restorative justice model as it was employed there. I'm not so excited about Sinn Féin. So, yeah, please.
Since the Tab Party Law in 1948, which effectively outlawed mass picketing, I've seen many, many, many strikes broken by cops protecting scabs dispersing picket lines. One of the reasons for the main reason for the weakness of the labor movement is the role of the cops as scab herders. Just one throwaway point. In Petrograd, in February 1917, when the Workers' Councils virtually took control of the working class districts, the workers' militia patrolled the streets. The cops disappeared, and all the criminals disappeared, and the workers' militia performed the function of keeping order. Oh, and one thing you haven't addressed, I wonder if you've addressed it in your book, the role of cops when they take people into custody outside the public view of police brutality and forcing confessions, etc. It's a major factor in many, many convictions, the way they solve so many cases, forcing confessions.
Well, this is a convenient opportunity for me to push my second book. American Methods, Torture and the Logic of Domination.
Pardon?
American Methods, Torture and the Logic of Domination.
Good.
I talk about that stuff in more detail there. I talk about the U.S. government's use of torture, both overseas in, places like Abu Ghraib, Guantanamo Bay, but also further back in history. And domestically, in prisons, police stations, patrol cars, etc., here in the U.S. So, if you want I could go on about that for a whole other two-hour talk. In fact, I have. So, if you want to get the book, either from me or from the library, and look there. Is there somebody who hasn't asked a question and wants to? Because I don't mind repeating, but okay, go ahead.
I'm not sure if we've run out of steam on this. I guess I'm just interested in hearing you talk a little bit about how class plays into this, because I feel like it's a really vital component that hasn't gotten too much airtime yet, and especially in the context of poorer people are more vulnerable to the police because they can't hide their activities in their car or in private space so well. And thus, poor people using drugs or whatever are much more visible and targetable than people who can, than the wealthy who can conceal their
activities. Right.
Anyway, that was long-winded.
No, not at all. I spend a whole chapter talking about cops in class, and there are several sort of dimensions to this. One is the police as strike breakers, which we've hit on already. One is that the police disproportionately patrol areas where poor people live or where they are. Your point that, people with fewer resources are sort of forced to occupy public space more and are seen as sort of less desirable in the public space, produces this sort of cycle of police targeting. Another thing is thing that's worth considering is the difference between sort of the definition of crime and how class-based assumptions get built into that. And not just at the level of sort of surveillance and enforcement, but just at the level of things that poor people do tend to become the business of the cops. Things that rich people do, even if they are in some respect illegal, tend to be the business of some regulatory agency. And the there tends to be a heavy, it's not mechanistic, but there tends to be a heavy class bias in the way the law is formulated, in the way that it's interpreted, in the way that it's enforced, and then the people who are the treatment of the suspects once they are in custody. And I traced that pattern back from about the from about the mid 18th century on. I'm sure it goes back further, but at the point before we had this modern institution, when slave patrols were maintaining order in the South, there were lots of behaviors that were specifically prohibited to slaves. And there were also, so for example, at different times in different places, any gathering of slaves, possessing alcohol, owning paper, owning guns, these were like not for them. And the slave patrols specifically enforced these black codes, which then showed up, slave codes, which showed up later after Reconstruction as black codes. The law was just, it drew a clear line among, between free and slave. Interestingly, once the slave patrols were established, their purview increased so that they, in some places, weren't just responsible for keeping an eye on the slave population, but were also responsible for, let me see if I can get the phrasing right, disciplining disreputable whites, I believe was the phrase used in the law. Meaning, what's a disreputable white? Well, one indicator of being a disreputable white was spending time with slaves. But they were typically, poor people, vagrants, that sort of thing. And the slave patrol, so their function expanded as they became institutionalized. During industrialization, we see a culture clash where there was a huge spike in immigration, and the native-born, mostly Protestant, sort of respectable classes were dismayed at the habits of the new immigrant, mostly Catholic, working classes, and began a series like, and so there was a sudden emphasis on public order offenses, things like drinking, gambling, prostitution, that sort of thing, which the Protestants had mostly kept in check by sort of moral austerity, and which the new immigrants with their foreign ways were threatening the sense of order. And so there was this huge push to treat as criminal offenses which previously had been informally managed. And that often just resulted in from this time, the phrase the criminal classes came, suggesting that it wasn't just the activities, it was something inherent in these people themselves. And police and judges often just treated it that way. There's a case that I cite in the book in which a couple in Philadelphia in about 1840 were arrested for kissing on the public street. And the judge was surprised and frustrated to find that he couldn't find an offense to correspond to kissing on the public street, but ordered them held for a week anyway, based on the reputation of the area that they were in. And I think we can find, it doesn't take too much insight to make a comparison between that kind of public order policing and the race and class dynamics involved there, and the kind of public order policing that suddenly became really popular again in the 90s, first in New York, but now everywhere.
So I just want to, I have to jump in right now.
Please.
Because Mr. Christie needs to go home by 9 o'clock. It's 9 at 9. But I would like to let people have time to talk to you individually afterwards, to talk to the Cop Watch folks who are here afterwards. I'm going to say if you have questions, you can just ask individually.
For one thing, about getting rid of police, the people in the besieged communities need and want those police there. They, the people who are not committing the street crimes. And we've been skirting this issue here regularly throughout this discussion. He mentioned something about that crime stopped when during the Soviet Revolution, the beginning of the Soviet Revolution, which points to what we need to know while we're doing these intermediary kinds of things about dealing with street crime. The street crime being different from board crime. Street crime is caused by the profit system. And these are the things that give rise to the violence and the desperation and all the horrors that come along with it. We need to know that, that that's our objective. You know, you know, what do you do about it? What do you do about it? You work to change the state. So it's our state.
Okay, I'll give you the last word. So I'll hang out if you have questions you're embarrassed to ask in front of the whole class. Go up and talk to me. There are books for sale. And, yeah.
Can I just make a quick announcement? Yeah, I'm in the spirit of kind of keeping this conversation going for folks who are interested. I'm with a group called Oakland 100 Support. Oakland 100 being the over 100 people arrested in January around the rebellions. And so, you know, we've just sort of noticed that a lot of the responses are sort of lingering on this idea of justice being, you know, the individual response to a cop and arresting this cop or jailing this cop. So we're going to be calling a general assembly on responses to police violence, which would be more of a discussion-oriented event. And we don't have a date yet. It's probably going to be in a month, maybe more. But I just want to put that on people's radar. If you're interested, email us at oakland100@gmail.com.
Would the Cop Watch people make yourselves obvious somehow so that people can find you if they're interested in talking to you? Okay, talk to him.